You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to our show, September 28th. This is the John C. Scott Political Forum. Today we'll feature Mo Goldman, who is one of the best immigration lawyers in America. We'll also talk with Rudy Garcia. He doesn't want to be a Democrat anymore. He's been a Democrat for 60 years. He wants to start his own new political party called We the People. We're going to find out how that's going to work out. And then we're going to talk with Dr. Stephen Zunis, our Middle East expert. A lot going on with Iran. We're getting closer to war as beats of war get louder. Paul Cunningham will be with us. He's the Ward 4 City Councilman, seeking another 4 years on the City Council of Tucson. David Sevier will be with us. He's a longtime educator and education writer for The Weekly. And then Ed Ackerley will be with us, and he is running for mayor of Tucson as an independent. We have a very busy show. I'm so glad you decided to join us. Let's go to Mo Goldman, our immigration lawyer extraordinary. Thank you so much, Mo. Welcome to our show. Thank you. We got asylum seekers.
Saturday afternoon with John C. Scott.
That's it. It's a great afternoon. I love it, too.
And what a lineup you have.
We have a good lineup. That's true. Asylum seekers.
And I don't know. Go ahead. Well, you start off, and I'll tell you what's going on.
Okay. Well, the asylum seekers who follow the rules are being stung by this ban. You've got, families waiting for months and months at the Mexican border, finally getting their chance to make their case before the U.S. asylum just in a week. But because they waited there, as officials recommended, they face a new reality. Anyone who travels through a third country and is seeking asylum after July 16th is going to be denied. They're seeking asylum where there is none. There's no asylum to seek. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but go ahead and talk about it, if you will, Mo. Well, I'm so glad you're with me.
I will tell you that yesterday I learned something new that was truly stunning, but really, you know, not all that surprising. As I've been, you know, calling into this show for the last couple of years and informing you of changes that have been going on. And it seemed like really every day a new official immigration policy was coming out of the DHS. And sure enough, I found out that every business day since taking control of DHS, the Trump administration has introduced new policies, some much larger and more significant than others. But it's one of the reasons why it's so hard to keep track of what's going on right now, because the policy changes are just drastic. I mean, it could go all the way to just changing where you file applications to, you know, major policies of, you know, of concern, like the Remain in Mexico, known as the Migrant Protection Protocols. And so, you know, you basically have a situation now where, if you want asylum to the U.S., your chances of even getting into the U.S. are slim to none. And even if you get to that point where you have a hearing, you know, under this new policy where you have to have requested asylum in any third country that you cross through, it basically precludes almost everybody from being able to seek asylum. And, you know, on top of that, these courts that the government has set up in tents in Laredo and Brownsville, Texas, they have allowed very limited access to lawyers that came down from D.C., from different NGOs, and also the media has had limited access to these hearings. So, you know, the big question is, what is the government trying to hide here? Which, you know, I think we can answer that by saying, you know, due process. There's a real concern about due process under this administration across the board, but especially when it comes to immigration processing. You know, this secretive nature and lack of transparency is really disturbing.
Well, you talk about slamming the door. Trump administration wants to cap the number of refugees admitted into the United States. It's at the lowest number since the resettlement program was created in 1980.
Correct. And, I mean, the last year we thought was low. It was at 30,000 as a cap. And for the fiscal year 2020, which starts in a couple of days, that would be lowered to 18,000 refugees. And then you have to look even behind that number of 18,000, and you'll realize that all, like 4,000 of those visas, those refugee numbers, are allocated to refugees from Iraq who have assisted with the U.S. military. Only 1,500 for Central Americans, and 5,000 for people who have been persecuted for their religion. Beyond that, there's 7,500 that are for people who are seeking family reunification and have already been cleared for resettlement. As a point of comparison, under President Obama, the cap in 2016 was 110,000, and the lowest, the floor for the G.W. Bush administration was 80,000. And, of course, now we're seeing a peak of refugees all around the world, more so than probably any time in recent memory. And U.S. is trying to avoid any responsibility for, you know, the obligations that we have stood for as a nation for years. So, yeah, it's really just tragic situation when it comes to asylum and refugee processing. And it remains to be seen what's going to, you know, happen next, how worse can it get?
You know, Judy Perry Martinez, who's president of the American Bar Association, had an op-ed in the Arizona Daily Star on Wednesday, and it's headlined by asylum seekers waiting for their day in court need access to legal counsel. What are the chances of those folks getting counsel? Are it 1%, 10%, 5%, or none?
Minimal. I would put the number at less than 5%. I don't think the chances of individuals at the border getting a lawyer to represent them is, you know, really a possibility in most cases. You're talking about locations that are, you know, really out of the way. I know I do have some colleagues that have taken trips to the border and have gone to like Brownsville or Laredo and have taken on some of these cases. But you're talking about, you know, probably walking out of your office, doing pro bono work, and leaving all the other work that you're trying to get through as an immigration lawyer specialist behind. And so it's difficult. You know, there's a lot of demand right now for lawyers like myself, and just there's not enough time. You know, we just don't have the manpower or the hours to do it. And so, yeah, the chances of getting any form of legal counsel in that sort of situation are, you know, very, very minimal.
This portion of the John C. Scott Show originates from the Perfection Auto Works studio, and my guest is Mo Goldman, immigration lawyer. I don't see this getting any better. In fact, every time I have a conversation with you, it gets worse. I don't know whether there's a cause factor here, but
I do have some positive news
Good.
To report to you.
Good.
I've said this before, the two ways to fight back on these policies are, number one, through the media, and number two, through the courts. And yesterday there were two major victories that came down. One of them was in the district court of the Central District of California. The district court judge, Dolly G, she's had this Flores settlement case in front of her, which is the case that involves migrant children that, the Trump administration would love to be holding them indefinitely, and have been trying to work on these workarounds of this settlement that went into effect back in 1997. What the settlement said was that there were standards set for the treatment of migrant children, and it included a requirement that the government release a migrant child by a non-licensed housing facility, in other words, a housing facility or detention center that's not licensed by a state, within 20 days of holding them. So if it's an ICE detention center, then it's not going to, you know, either they're going to have to let them go after 20 days. And if they want to hold the child beyond the 20 days, it'd have to be in a licensed facility by the state. Now, as of today, no state has a licensed family center, which holds a family unit. And so what the Trump administration tried to do to as a workaround on this is and superseding the settlement is they put in place new regulations that argue that ICE facilities for families comply with this rule. And the judge came down really, you know, pretty harsh on that, on the administration, claiming that, you know, this agreement was a binding contract, and that it's violation of the rule of law by trying to, you know, impose this new regulation. And she enjoined, she actually did an order of a permanent injunction against the Trump administration for doing this. And it remains to be seen whether the administration will take it to the Ninth Circuit. But that's a huge victory for, you know, a lot of organizations that have been fighting this in the federal court and for the rights of releasing these children who shouldn't be held, in my opinion, for any length of time, but let alone, you know, the 20 days. There was also a decision out of D.C., and this involved expedited removal. Now, expedited removal is it's been in the law for a long time. And what it allows for is it allows for ICE or CBP to remove an individual without a hearing in front of a judge if they're encountered within either 2 years of their entry, if they entered by sea and they can't prove that they've been here more than 2 years, or if they arrive by land, it's typically just on the border. So if they get caught within 100 miles of the border and they can't prove that they've been in the U.S. for more than 14 days at that time, ICE can or CBP can execute an expedited removal. Again, no judge needs to be involved. What Trump and his administration have been doing is they're trying to get an expansion of expedited removal, which would allow any DHS employee, if they found anyone within the U.S., anywhere in the United States, and if that person can't prove that within 2 years of their entry, that they've been here more than that time, they can remove them and circumvent the court system.
By the way,
and there was a decision out of the District Court of D.C. That granted a preliminary injunction against the government from expanding this expedited removal, and that came down yesterday as well. So it was two big victories, and I think as long as they continue to battle it out in the courts, and most of these come from either ACLU or, you know, big NGOs in D.C. or across the country that are bringing these suits, I think they're going to be able to hold things up, and, you know, we'll see what happens in the election next year. So, yeah, it's not all bad news. There is some good news out there.
Well, this is the federal judge that blocked the Trump administration from dramatically expanding its power to deport migrants who have illegally entered the United States using, I think it's called a fast-track deportation process that bypasses immigration judges. That's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, expedited removal is that fast track.
So, and then a 126-page ruling, you got Brown Jackson out of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia issuing a nationwide, I think, preliminary injunction. And that was shortly before midnight yesterday, I believe. And the federal judge blocks the administration from detaining migrant children for indefinite periods. You're right. There's something to be positive about.
And, you have to take your victories, which are probably few and far between right now, and be happy that they happen. And, you know, beyond that, I think it's important to keep an eye on this. There's a bill right now in the Senate that could be going to a vote, you know, pretty soon, within maybe in the next couple of weeks. The bill is titled Fairness for High-Skilled Immigrants Act. It already passed the House by a huge number. The margin was 365-65 back in July. It's a problematic bill, to say the least, because what it does is it does attempt to help Indian and Chinese citizens who are currently backlogged for green card visas. Many of them are backlogged for over a decade just to get a green card. If you're from India, for example, some of the wait times could be upwards of 50 years. I think I've talked about that before on your show. But what they've done is instead of just expanding the number of green cards that the government can allocate and enlarge that quota, and maybe, you know, have some additional exemptions from the cap, they're basically taking the system and turning it on its head, where the number of visas are going to stay the same at 140,000 green card visas for each fiscal year for employment-based sponsorship. And then what they'll do is they're going to do kind of a first-come, first-serve order instead of what we've had previously, which is per country 7% of the overall quota per country allocations. And of course, India has traditionally had the most applicants. In fact, there's about 370,000 Indian nationals Wow. currently in line waiting for green cards. And what's going to wind up happening is, you know, India and China will be able to hopefully alleviate those backlogs, but it's going to take about 10 years. And then every other country is going to be also stuck with long wait times. Wow. So it's that, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul situation. And it's definitely a problem. There's better solutions for this, but I think you're going to end up seeing, if they do pass this bill and it does get signed into law, a long wait time for people from across the rest of the world.
Mo Goldman, it is so great to talk with you. You do such an incredible amount of work for so many people and change the lives of so many people. And I just thank you for being on the show. It's always great. I learn from you every time. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, I just want to mention, if you want to read a little more about that Senate bill, it's Senate Bill 386.
Right, 386.
So 386. You should check it out and read about it, because it's definitely going to have major impact on the processing times.
My homework.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much, Mo. Good talk with you. Have a great weekend. Thanks for spending part of yours with us. Thank you. Mo Goldman, one of the best immigration lawyers in America. This portion of the John C. Scott Talk Show originates from the Perfection Auto Works Studio. By the way, Tucson Map and Flag announces concierge service. The Tucson Map and Flag store that Tucsonans grew to love is now closed. Tucson Map and Flag, but is open during business hours on your phone. Call Charles Smith of American Flag. He is an expert on the American flag. Call him at 887-4234. 887-4234. Order your American-made flag at a great price. Almost any size is available. Tucson Map and Flags, one of the very best stores in all of America, still open on your phone. Now, concierge service of Tucson Map and Flag, just a phone call away. Call Charles Smith at 887-4234 and place your order. Tucson Map and Flag, sharing your pride in America with a display of America's most cherished symbol. Call 887-4234. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum on this Saturday afternoon. I'm so glad you decided to join us. With us is Rudy Garcia. We talked to him a few years back. He ran for the United States Senate against John McCain. Do you remember that race? And he's still been political. In fact, he's been a Democrat for 60 years. But he's changing his political philosophy and approach to solving some of the problems of the world through the political system. Here's Rudy Garcia. Hi, Rudy.
Hey, Mr. Scott. How are you, sir?
I'm well. You were a Democrat for 60 years. Now what?
Well, let me tell you. I changed parties because I finally saw the light. I'm over 83 right now, and it took me a while, but I finally saw the light, because all you need to do is just stop and think. Obviously, I wasn't doing that, and obviously, people that are on the other side, they're not thinking. We are not thinking of what's going on right now. I believe that both parties, Republican and Democrat, they're just like tennis players. They're using the American people like a ping pong ball, back and forth, back and forth. And finally, it took me a while, like I said, but I finally opened up my eyes and I saw what was going on. I said, enough is enough. So that's why I went to the Independent Party. But now I have started an organization called We the People here in Tucson, and I believe that we can do some serious, serious change for the betterment of the people here in Tucson, here in Pima County, here in the state of Arizona, and in the rest of the country. But we need to get together, and we need to get together as soon as possible. The clock is ticking, and it's ticking very, very fast on us. Now, I have a little bit of experience. I was a mayor of a city in California, and I processed over 100,000 people for citizenship. And the most important thing that I did a recall of an entire city council. So, having said that, I have a little bit of experience, and I'd like to have some people that would like to see their country change. But let's start with our city, see some real change. In the past, we've heard a lot of this change here and change that. Is nothing. Nothing ever comes from these people that are talking change. But we, the people as a whole, we can create some real, real change. And let me tell you, we need to know one thing. The government that we have is a government that we deserve, okay? And we have what we have right now is because we are sitting on our hands, not doing anything about it. At my age, I'm willing to get out there and let's do something, but I need help of everybody, not just one or two people.
I'm going to give people an opportunity to contact you and get involved, but you know, we have an independent running for mayor. I think the number of votes that's going to go the way of Ed Ackerley, and it's going to be a large number. I don't know whether he's going to win or not. It's a tremendous uphill battle against all the Democrats and their large numbers of registration over Republicans and independents. It might be too high a mountain to climb, but he's going to be halfway up there, and he's going to show people that independents can really capture a huge, significant amount of the vote. And I think that's going to be an amazing story out of this mayoral race because he's a qualified candidate. He didn't want to run as an independent. He wanted to run as an independent, but not as a Republican or Democrat. And I think that's significant. We'll see the highest number of votes ever cast for an independent in our history in this election 2019. How do people join your effort?
Well, I have a web page that's, let me tell you, the I'm not too, remember, my age doesn't help me very much, but I have a webpage called wethepeople50.us. Okay, you can drop me a line there. And like I said, I need people to get in touch with me. We need to move forward. And by the way, I am supporting Mr. Ed Ackerley. He's our man. We need to get him elected, okay? We need to get him elected. First of all, I don't believe that our city should become a sanctuary city. Okay, I don't believe that. And people don't stop to think, again, if we become an independent city, who is going to support and feed and house and everything else for these people? We can't even support ourselves, for crying out loud. And if we do something like that, well, the federal government will slap a fine, I believe, that's $125 million that will be taken away from Tucson. We can't afford that. We cannot afford that. I don't care what anybody says. So we the people, this is our plan. We intend to do the following. We don't want to fight City Hall. We want to become City Hall. We want to run the city of City Hall. The whole city of Tucson be involved in running that city, not a few individuals, okay? Because I've learned now through the years that once you elect an individual, he gets out there and does whatever he wants to. No, it's not going to be like that any longer. We, the people, we have to have a watchdog system here. Because this individual is not just going to go up there and vote on whatever he thinks is right. No, it's got to go to a committee. That committee is going to say yay or nay. And term limits is right on top of that. The reason for that is because if you have term limits, Mr. Scott, that reduces the chances of being corrupt. Follow what I'm saying?
I do.
We have individuals in Congress right now, and local cities and whatnot, they've been there forever. The other day, a gentleman died in the Senate. He'd been there 35 years. Well, that doesn't surprise me because we have people there 50 years service. By the way, all of these people are multimillionaires. What does that tell you? We don't pay, the government doesn't pay that much money to our servants, but yet these people make a lot of money. Well, we need to get rid of everything that's hurting America. We need to stop that, because if we don't, only God knows where we're going with this. Republicans and Democrats are nothing more than a pair of unfit parents in a custody battle over America. They're not hurting each other as much as they're hurting America.
By the way, let's go to your website again. It's We the People, what, 50-something? Tell me again. We the People, what?
We the People, 50.
50.
Dot.
Okay. Okay. We the People,
US.
50. Dot what? What?
U.S.
Oh, U.S.
U.S.
Okay, U.S. All right. Very good. And I guess people could just, I don't know, pick up the phone and talk to you, but will your phone number be on the website? Can people communicate with you in some way or another if they want to do that beyond our interview today?
Well, I don't have a problem with that because I am a people person. I want to talk to the people. And the reason is that, look, at my age, I want to help people so they can do it themselves. The clock's ticking on me, Mr. Scott. The clock's ticking on me. I'm not a spring chicken any longer. And I want to make sure that we get our kids, get everybody. I mean, when I say everybody, I don't mean just a certain group. No, I mean everybody. There's no boundaries here. Hispanics, Anglos, Blacks, Yellow, whatever. Whatever. We need all the people to be on the same page, and we can have control of our city, our county, our state, and our country. It's going to take everybody to do this, and we can do it.
Well, Rudy, thank you for being on the air today. Thanks for trying to make a change in the way we do things, because a lot of what we try to do is not working. You know, there's a lot of flaws in this.
No, it's not.
Two-party system. But I think we're going to see some changes as an independent. Ed Ackerley is going to get more votes than any independent in the history of the city, and I think that's going to open the door for other independents to run as well. And I think we're going to see all this outside money that's going to go toward trying to elect Raina Romero as mayor by mandate. And we're talking about millions of dollars thrown into the campaign in the primary. That was just an outlandish corruption of the system. Nothing clean about that clean elections campaign. And I think people are going to reject that as it continues in our local politics. But that door has been opened wide now, too, for outside money to be influential in city council races, as well as for the board of supervisors and other local races. So
yes.
That cat's out of the bag. Thanks, Rudy, for being on the air with us today. I hope people will follow your lead and get involved. Thank you.
I have one more question for you,
sir. Sure.
Could I come back some of the point in time and have another few minutes with you?
Sure, absolutely. We'll do that soon. I'll give you a call. We'll do part two.
All righty. I have more stuff for you then.
All right. Thanks so much.
Like I said, I need a lot of help.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. We appreciate you being on the air with us today, Rudy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rudy Garcia. It's talking about We the People, 50.us. If you want to find out more about who he is and what he is and what he's trying to do. Coming up next, Dr. Stephen Zunis, our University of San Francisco Middle East expert. I don't think anybody's more respected when it comes to taking a look at what's happening in the Middle East. We've talked with him for 25 years. He's been our expert. You can read him in many publications all across the globe. He's one of the most respected Middle East observers of politics in all of the world. Dr. Stephen Zunis, University of San Francisco, my guest next. This portion of the John C. Scott Show originates from the Perfection Auto Works Studios. This portion of the John C. Scott Show originates from the Perfection Auto Works Studios. Let's go to our Middle East expert in San Francisco, from the University of San Francisco, Dr. Stephen Zunis. Doctor, welcome to the show. Thanks for spending a Saturday afternoon with us. Thank you.
Good to be with you.
All right, we've been talking about Benjamin Netanyahu, it seems like, for decades. Let's keep talking about him. What are his chances of surviving this political maelstrom in Israel now? Is there any way he can prevail?
Oh, he has his block of supporters and his opponents, the block of supporters, have ended up in a virtual tie. The president of Israel, which is a largely symbolic position, but they are the ones, he is the one who can request a particular candidate to lead the effort to form a coalition government, has chosen Netanyahu to try it first. He may or may not succeed, but the fact that he was chosen first is some indication that he may have the best opportunity. Israel has a proportional representation system, so that the head of the largest party and the largest coalition is the one who becomes a prime minister. And so you have to get this coalition of different parties, some of which have very different agendas, and try to hold them together. And Netanyahu, I mean, he's a survivor. I mean, when you and I first started talking back 20 years ago, Netanyahu's first round of prime minister, we thought he was dead back then because of corruption charges and other things. But my God, that guy keeps on coming back. And this guy's Energizer Bunny. I mean, he's just amazing. When everybody writes him off as politically finished, he seems to come back. So just last week, people, including myself, were writing him off as finally finished. But he may indeed be able to hobble something together.
Stephen, the influence of Donald Trump does not seem to be this great in this election as it was in the last one, which seems like 2 weeks ago or just very recently. Is Trump playing a role this time around?
Well, Trump has been a strong supporter of Netanyahu. He dangled the possibility of a formal defense treaty between Israel and the United States, which, despite the very close relationship between the two countries, no president has really put forward before. And it was largely seen as an effort to bolster Netanyahu's chances. And indeed, Netanyahu and his Likud party has done. It has generally been not supported by previous administrations, even Republican ones. I mean, the first Bush administration actually postponed a proposed $10 billion loan guarantee to Israel in the hopes that it would help the Likud party's opponents. And it did. It ended up in a labor victory, and which then in turn led to the Oslo Accords. But and Trump, by contrast, has been quite openly supportive of Netanyahu. He's part of this kind of far-right populist movement we've seen in places like Poland, Hungary, India, Brazil, and elsewhere that Trump seems to identify with and support. And so he has been trying to push things, because the relationship with the United States is really important to Israelis. I mean, the United States is virtually the only country that has supported Israeli policies in recent years. And while most of America's democratic allies certainly support Israel's right to exist and peace and security, the hardline policies of Netanyahu of colonization and continuing the occupation is unpopular, even among Israel's traditional allies like Britain and France. And so the desire to please the United States and a candidate's ability to say, hey, the U.S. supports me, is certainly still a plus in Israel. At the same time, Netanyahu's policies are controversial, to be sure, not to mention his personal corruption, which has led to a whole series of criminal investigations. Indeed, part of Netanyahu's desperate desire to remain in power is not just to advance his political agenda, but to keep him in jail.
By the way, these headlines, subpoenas lead to the first concrete steps for Trump's impeachment investigation. That can't help Netanyahu. That has to weaken our president in every part of the world, doesn't it? I mean, Trump cannot be as forceful today as he was a week ago, 2 weeks ago, a month ago. He can't be. He's threatened with removal from office.
The reputation of the United States has certainly declined under the Trump presidency. But interestingly, if you look at public opinion surveys from around the world, the opinion of people towards the United States has declined in every single country, just about, except for Israel. Israel is the one country where Trump's
support has actually increased because, unlike Obama, despite his strong support for Israel, Obama, despite his strong support for Israel, including the highest aid package ever provided to that country, he was willing to challenge Netanyahu on a number of policies, including the settlements and colonization and that kind of thing. And whereas Trump has pretty much given Netanyahu a blank check. I mean, every appointee he has had, including his son-in-law, on Israeli-Palestinian issues, has been a significant supporter of the settlement agenda and some of the very hard-line policies that even previous Republican administrations have seriously questioned.
You know, it seems to me, as we take a look at the transcripts of the communication between the Ukrainian president and President Trump, and now learn that President Trump has discussed foreign policy openly with the Russians inside the White House, I'm not so sure any country in the world can have any confidence in a communication with this government. I don't see how they can feel at least confident that they're going to have any kind of security involved or any kind of reasonable approach to solving any of the problems. I mean, we don't have a State Department anymore. We don't have a foreign policy anymore. We've got nothing. We have nothing.
Well said, John. I mean, when I go to academic conferences with other Middle East scholars and everything, you know, the question is about, Middle East policy under Trump. The question is, do we even have a Middle East policy? Do we have any kind of foreign policy at all? I mean, the Trump administration has failed to fill key posts. I mean, in the State Department, we're talking about assistant secretaries of state covering some of the key regions of the world. We're talking about ambassadors to very important countries. Now, and this has upset not just, of course, liberals and others who believe that diplomacy and a strong foreign service and State Department are important, but even conservatives who tend to agree with Trump's views and wish he would appoint more conservative activists to these positions, but he hasn't seemed to get around to it. Your whole point about the reputation of the United States and the world declining is an understatement, is very, very valid. But the fact is that, remember, Israel has been under a very hardline nationalistic leadership that seems to care very little about international opinion to push its hardline agenda. And they're quite pleased to find in Washington someone who actually agrees with them and supports this agenda.
Amazing. Stephen, let me take a quick break and come back and conclude with some thoughts that I have, as well as some information I need concerning our relationship with Iran and how the war drums are sounding at the moment. So come back with me in just a moment, will you please?
Sure will.
Dr. Stephen Tunis, University of San Francisco, our Middle East expert. We've talked to him for over two decades, and we continue the conversation today. It's almost the same one we had two decades ago. Back with Dr. Stephen Tunis after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum on this Saturday afternoon. With us, Dr. Stephen Tunis, University of San Francisco. We know that there's still a liability and a real question mark about what the relationship between the United States and Iran is going to be here in the next week, next month, or tomorrow, or an hour from now. What do you foresee as this has somewhat been resolved to a particular point, but it's still a chance for a real flame-up and a chance for a possible conflict with Iran? How possible is that conflict, Stephen?
Well, the good news is that the crisis we've talked about in recent weeks seems to have diffused somewhat. The reaction by the United States of blaming Iran for an attack on Saudi oil facilities that was apparently committed by a rebel group in Yemen seems to have. The Trump administration has basically been trying to has been downplaying that at this point, in large part because they haven't found any evidence that Iran was responsible So I think the initial crisis may have diffused somewhat, but the problem is that the United States really seems to have it out for Iran. I mean, Iran, of course, is a very nasty regime, but their responsibility for various conflicts around the region has been exaggerated somewhat. I mean, just as the Soviet Union's responsibility for various left-wing nationalist revolutions during the Cold War was often exaggerated, the idea that these Iranian allies are depicted as Iranian proxies, you know, that is, denying the agency of these particular movements and saying, oh, they're just puppets of Iran. I mean, that's not, not only is that not accurate, but it basically creates a situation where every terrorist act or every militant action, the United States says, oh, Iran is responsible, and therefore we have to go after Iran, then that's rather, rather dangerous and irresponsible, in my view. And it creates a situation where any little incident by some, say a Houthi commander ends up, you know, bringing in a drone attack or a rocket attack against, say, a Saudi airbase. Well, we have their U.S. troops in some of these Saudi bases, where we have advisors in in Saudi Arabia. What if an American soldier gets killed by one of these rocket attacks? Now, that's not the intent of the Yemeni Houthi rebels, and it's certainly not the intent of Iran. But if we keep saying, oh, the Houthis are just proxies of Iran, therefore Iran attacked the United States, therefore that's an act of war, therefore that's an excuse for the U.S. to end up bombing some Iranian facility in retaliation, and the Iranians saying, oh, we're under attack by the United States, therefore we need to send our missiles to attack the United States for real, and all of a sudden we've got a major war on our hands. So I think it's really, really important that on the one hand, let's not have any pretense about the nasty nature of the Iranian regime, but this tendency to exaggerate their reach, to depict every ally as some kind as an arm of the Iranian government, and therefore blame the Houthis or some Shia militia in Iraq or Hezbollah in Lebanon or whatever as therefore a part of parcel of Iran. That's creating a scenario where almost any kind of minor incident could be blown totally out of proportion and end up in a major war that involves the United States. And what's very weird about this is, let's remember that Saudi Arabia, which was on the receiving end of that Houthi attack a few weeks ago, they're a very powerful country. I mean, they have their military budget, annual military budget, is six times larger than that of Iran. And they are perfectly capable of defending themselves. And I think we have to ask ourselves, is it worth risking American lives and treasury to defend a country that is perfectly capable of defending itself? And do we really need to fight Iran, which, of course, is a reactionary, authoritarian state, to defend another reactionary, authoritarian state, Saudi Arabia? Is that really in America's best interest?
Well, let me ask you this, Stephen. Is our president so unhinged? Is our president so tenuous about holding on to his office in light of the movement to impeach him that he would lean toward a war to escape an impeachment or the particular outpouring of disgust about this president from the people of the United States? I mean, is he capable of saying, we'll go to war to keep my job? I mean, we always worried about that with Nixon. I'm even more worried about it with Trump. Is he capable of doing that?
I mean, there's always the risk of a wag the dog kind of scenario, and people do tend to rally around the flag when there is war, regardless of their political party or the particular circumstances involved. And so, we really do have there really is, I think, a risk of that sort of thing. At the same time, Trump, I think one reason Trump actually got the Republican nomination, and indeed one reason he was able to defeat Hillary Clinton, who was definitely on the hawkish wing of the Democratic Party, was that he depicted himself as someone who is not as prone as many to get us involved in these foreign entanglements. I mean, he really pushed this idea of America first. And I think he knows that if he got us into an illegal and unnecessary war, he would not only get, of course, the opposition of many liberals and anti-war type constituents, but many people in his base, you know, that really did see, who embraced more of an isolationist kind of view, a view that we're tired of these endless overseas wars, not because they're liberals or pacifists or that they're particularly big on international law or human rights, but just that they really do believe that we should put our resources more into our needs at home rather than these unnecessary foreign entanglements. So I think on the one hand, you're right. There is a risk, given the nature of Trump, that he could do something crazy like that. On the other hand, you know, he's been famous or infamous for doing whatever it takes to stoke his base, you know, whether it be on, you know, immigration or other kinds of issues. And it seemed very unlikely that he would be willing to risk alienating his base by getting himself into a war, because, you know, not only did he challenge his Republican opponents during the 2016 primaries on this, but remember, he actually ran to Hillary Clinton's left on foreign policy.
You're absolutely right. He did. Stephen, we're out of time. I got to go to the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Dr. Stephen Sunis, University of San Francisco.